please the court. My name is Bruce Galloway. I'm an attorney from Ozark, Missouri. I represent Carl Smith. Mr. Smith, I filed a writ of habeas corpus on Smith's behalf. The court granted a stay of a sentence that he was serving in the Ozark County Jail subsequent to an order of commitment issued by the trial judge following his conviction for contempt of court. He was sentenced to 4 months. He served approximately 30 days before the court issued the stay. While there are several issues that I am asking the court to consider as to the writ of habeas corpus, the dispositive issue would appear to be whether the conviction as applied violated the First Amendment. Jurisdiction is given this court because there is no appeal from a writ of habeas corpus. The remedy is extraordinary writ, and the Southern District had declined to hear it. The standard of review is whether the court exceeded the law. Our position is that this case should not have reached the jury, as this was a jury trial, for a finding of guilt, because the prosecution violated the First Amendment. In reviewing a criminal contempt conviction, and this is an indirect contempt conviction, the rule is that of strict construction in favor of the contender, and that comes from the Tannenbaum decision, Tannenbaum against Clark, cited in my brief. Thornton against Doyle, 969 Southwest 2nd, 342, states that Rule 36.01, under which the Attorney General pursued the prosecution for criminal contempt, should be liberally construed to protect the rights of an alleged contemnor. There are rules that are particular to indirect contempt. And if I may define indirect contempt, indirect contempt is allegedly contemptuous actions or statements that occur outside of the hearing of the court. In this case, Mr. Smith was accused of writing a writ of prohibition concerning a criminal matter, in which in the portion of the writ of prohibition where it says statements why writ should issue, he wrote approximately two paragraphs. The two paragraphs are cited in the appendix to my brief, but essentially raised the argument that the respondent judge, the person that did not try this case, conduct, along with other members of the 44th Judicial Circuit, created at least an appearance of impropriety and at most a criminal conspiracy to use the grand jury for an improper purpose of coercing. Mm-hmm.
Does the record indicate what, if any, investigation the attorney did concerning those allegations or their truth?
Yes. They're attached with the legal file is an entire copy of the writ of prohibition that was filed by Mr. Smith. Attached to that were affidavits, letters to and from the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel, docket sheets, and and in particular, an affidavit written by his client at the time, Mr. Ron Jarrett, which contained three rather spurious accusations as to certain members of the 44th Judicial Circuit. That affidavit of Mr. Jarrett was subsequently found to be false in his perjury trial later. However, that prosecution for perjury did not occur, Your Honor, at the time. Had not occurred at the time that Mr. Smith wrote the writ of prohibition.
I guess what my question relates to is, other than relying on the statement of his client, did he do any independent or further investigation, or did he just take his client's word for it, so to speak?
The evidence in this criminal trial has, and I will answer your question, all that is in before the record for this court would be the exhibits that were attached, which included statements about conduct of the various people described, and whether that would constitute an independent investigation, I suppose, is something the court may review. But the evidence that was presented to the jury in this criminal trial did not consist of those exhibits and did not direct itself to the efforts of Mr. Smith to verify the statements that were attached to the exhibits. Actually, what had occurred is the jury was only shown essentially the two paragraphs of the statements reasons why writ should issue. So the issue of investigation was never raised as part of this case.
Well, the statute which you quote on page 50 of your brief says, and I assume that they were proceeding on number one, 476.110, disorderly, contemptuous, or insolent behavior committed during its session in its immediate view and presence, directly tending to interrupt its proceedings or to impair the respect due to its authority. Is that the one that the state's, is that the state's theory?
Well, I don't know, because there apparently are two bodies of law dealing with contempt, which was subject to several pretrial motions, including my request for a bill of particulars. The statute would seem to preclude a prosecution of Mr. Smith because the writing in the writ of prohibition, the two paragraphs, was not presented to Judge Carter in open court in the immediate view and presence.
Does the state take the position it's the common law contempt? Then
I believe so.
And it's your position that they failed to in addition to the First Amendment issues, I think you've raised that the instruction did not submit clear and present danger, and that the notice of contempt did not have sufficiently detailed facts to meet the requirements of common law contempt?
What I think that the state refers to common law contempt is 36.01 contempt. And our position is that the instructions that we tendered followed, as we understood, the common law to be, and among those was an actual obstruction of the administration of justice that was not included in the court's instructions to the jury. That was important in this case because the state had conceded, and a stipulation was read to the jury, that in fact, the presiding judge over the grand jury, was in no way affected by the filing of this writ, that the judge had in fact granted Mr. Smith, Attorney Smith, 7 days to file a writ of prohibition following his overruling of a motion to quash. And there was no evidence that the subpoena that was challenged under Mr. Smith's writ of prohibition was not honored, or that the grand jury deliberations was hampered.
And as a requirement, is your position of indirect contempt that that the contempt posed an imminent threat to the judicial function, or what is the standard we apply?
The requirement would be that it actually impeded the administration of justice or court order.
Well, actually, the jury directing instruction says the defendant's statements degraded and made impotent the authority of the Circuit Court of Douglas County Associate Circuit Division and impeded and embarrassed the administration of justice. Is that not the state's position? Or that was the theory of their case?
Well, it seemed to me, Your Honor, that the theory of the case was one of defamation. And there also seemed to be no evidence, Your Honor, that there was any impeding of the administration of justice. It also seemed that the instruction carried far more verbiage than what the common law required. But if I may say, though, that to get to the central point of Your Honor's question, I believe, I'm not sure that it is a jury question to say, to ask them whether the First Amendment was violated. And the First Amendment challenge, the question is, was there, as a matter of law, a statement that created an imminent peril or danger to the administration of justice? And Missouri law follows has the requirement that a trial judge at the end of the trial in his orders of commitment and judgment set out the specific facts stating why there was contempt. And in the Wood case, which is cited in my reply brief and explained in my reply brief, comes from the United States Supreme Court. I'm running out of time. But it deals with exactly the same situation, and they said that the record was entirely devoid of anything showing how the administration was affected by comments made by an elected sheriff in the course of a grand jury proceeding, comments that questioned the integrity of the judicial system, and in particular that grand jury.
May it please the court. Criminal contempt is punitive in nature. It acts to protect, preserve, and vindicate the authority and dignity.
Are you proceeding under the statute, or are you proceeding under the common law?
Under the this court's rule, Your Honor, 36.01b. Criminal contempt.
And is it also your position that under 36.01, then there's no obligation to comply with Rule 21 or the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. And I've said that more fully in my brief. I will intend to address the issues raised by petitioner, the First Amendment issues, but if the court has any questions about any of the other
I do, since we try to resolve things on non-constitutional issues first before we reach constitutional issues, and some serious questions have been raised about the jury instruction, didn't submit intent, didn't it submit clear and present danger or any kind of standard for finding contempt. Can you address why that was appropriate and where that instruction came from?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Yes, the state's verdict director tracked both the charges by Judge Craig Carter, and also attract the case law set forth by this court in several matters that have transpired since. For example, Bridges versus California, the cases of Thornton and Chasing, and forgive my pronunciation there, and Curtis versus Tozer. In those cases, this court held that indirect contempt arises from an act outside the court, tends to degrade or make impotent the authority of the court, or to impede or embarrass the administration of justice.
Is there no intent, or is there no issue of falsity or truth, or the question earlier was asked about investigation?
Yeah, the jury was presented with was asked to find, and the jury did find beyond a reasonable doubt, that the petitioner had made this statement and that statement, and that in doing so, those statements had
degraded.
So, and this would not be the case here. I'm not addressing the truth or falsity here, but say we had a hypothetical situation where, in fact, a judge had acted in violation of the law or a conspiracy or a fraud or some other. By saying that, you would, under this statute, the person under this instruction, the person would nonetheless be found guilty of contempt, regardless of the, under the way it was phrased, under this instruction.
No.
Okay,
no,
tell me why not.
The person would have the opportunity to as set forth in 36.01B, mm-hmm. to be present, to have a hearing, to take part. In this case,
but the fact finder wasn't required to find that it was the statements were untrue. So it doesn't
or made
what the
with
argued, right.
Right, or made without what the intent was, what
right.
they were instead. So in effect, someone, I think the First Amendment argument it ties in is someone's going to be chilled if they are concerned that there's an impropriety. They'll be afraid to even raise that for fear they'll be held in contempt. And isn't that a violation of not only our case law, which requires much more, but also the First Amendment?
See, but I don't believe that's the case. Anyone who's accused of criminal contempt, and as the court is well aware, it's a different animal. It's sui generis. It's of its own.
Well,
it's not a criminal case.
Let me interrupt you just
sure.
a second. Rule 3601 is a rule of procedure, which the court has the authority under the Constitution to do. But under the Constitution, it can have no substantive content. And so what is the source of this law?
The source of the law, the courts have found that it is inherent in the Constitution of the state, inherent in the courts of this state to be able to preserve and protect and vindicate the authority of their courts. So the courts have found it an inherent power by these courts, by not only this court, by the lower courts, to protect themselves against these very
Let me ask you, what's the indicia of impotence on the part of the court?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How do you show impotence on the part of the court?
That particular word was not specifically addressed other than...
What's in the instruction?
Judge Carter did indicate that these statements were made. None of these statements were true. These allegations that I had in some way conspired with somebody to fix a grand jury, for want of a better expression, or been corrupt.
But the fact that these statements were made only in a pleading, they really weren't publishing, like as in the Westfall case, does this rise to the level of contemptuous behavior?
Yes, Your Honor, because it is published in terms, it's a public record. It's a public record both in the Southern District Court of Appeals and also in the Circuit Court of Douglas County. So it is a public record. And it's capable, and you or I could go in and grab that file and say, look, something's been filed against Judge Carter that says he's corrupt. There must be something to it. And what's important is this
case
published,
was that published in a newspaper or on a radio or something? Was it?
There was no evidence of that, Your Honor, in one way or another. But Judge Carter indicated these statements happened, they occurred, and there was no contrary evidence. And the opportunity.
Did Mr. Smith make any attempt to publish it or send it to the media or do anything, post it anywhere?
These particular statements, no. These particular statements, no. As counsel indicated, there were attachments that were not presented to the jury, attachments to his petition that had been made public, but that was not considered
and
by
the would it
jury.
Be contempt if he made those statements in good faith, that he believed they had a possible basis in fact?
If he believed that he would have the opportunity to show that.
What is the law that for criminal contempt? Does it have to be false? Does it have to be uttered in good faith or not uttered in bad faith? Does it have to be something, a reasonable belief? What is the standard for contempt?
The courts have not said. The courts have said statements that degrade and make impotent the authority of the court and impede and embarrass the judge.
No, they haven't just said
that,
though.
That could apply to truthful statements.
Exactly.
It could. Yeah. And that's why the petitioner has the opportunity to come into court and
but he'd still be guilty.
No.
Well, then, what's the standard? So there's more than just that. What else is the standard that would make a truthful statement not?
Well, he would have the opportunity to explain to the jury that these statements were truthful, and truthful statements would be a total defense.
Not under the instruction.
No, not under the instruction.
Is
you
it your position that truth is an affirmative defense that must be submitted by the other, or is that an element that untruthfulness an element that you must establish?
It would be my stance, Your Honor, that it's something he must assert. He is mm-hmm. giving
It's a different matter. It's not a criminal.
At trial, did the defendant testify as to what, if any, effort he made to determine whether these statements were true?
No. He was given an opportunity, but he presented no contrary evidence to the jury. He was given a jury trial, which is not mandatory for a contempt case. He was given a jury trial. The jury found beyond a reasonable doubt this fact. And then Judge Witt, who was presiding and brought in from a county hundreds of miles away, presided. He affirmed the jury's decision by his judgment of contempt and then by his judgment of conviction, in which he sentenced the petitioner. I'm sorry.
Didn't Judge Carter indicate that these statements did not impede or affect the decision that he made?
He did.
Is that a defense then?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I would equate this case to the cases that I've cited here, State versus Adams and State versus Sella, one of which this court decided. But those are cases where individuals, not lawyers, laypersons, were charged with tampering with the judge, and that judge said it did not affect my decisions, but it could. And that's the very same instance here. But the difference we have here is this is a lawyer who should know better. And his statements are taken by people out in the... If a mechanic told me I've got a head gasket that's blown, I put a little faith in that. If a lawyer tells me that I've got a judge who's corrupt or he's working with the grand jury, somehow subverting it, that carries more weight.
But you have the canons of ethics as per the Westfall case. There's other remedies besides contempt of court.
There certainly are, Your Honor, but there's not a single case that I could find anyway that, for example, petitioner cited Rule 55.03C, I believe, as being one in which sanctions can be issued, but I don't believe that's ever been used, at least that I could find, in a contempt type proceeding.
I was concerned, though, that a lot of the cases you cited in your brief, you seem to sort of intermix citing cases talking about ethical violations versus cases talking about criminal contempt, and those are very different. And the standard for an ethical violation, appearance of impropriety and to have certain duties to the court, is probably far easier to meet than meeting the clear and present danger standard.
Well,
of indirect criminal contempt.
But I think this court has indicated that degraded and made impotent the authority of the court rises to the level of clear and present danger. And I also cited two cases, one from Indiana and one from Illinois, where those very same things occurred. For example, in the Illinois case, D'Agostino versus Lynch, I was a lawyer who had filed something, and the court found it contemptuous. And it found it beyond the pale. And, you know, the very same thing happened. The court said it didn't affect me, but it discussed the clear and present danger standard, and it also discussed essentially the language that we used in our verdict.
I'm afraid you would find, you know, maybe a quarter of the emotions for a hearing contemptuous under your standard.
I understand that completely. And, you know, I think one thing that's important for this court to remember is this petitioner was given 7 extra days by Judge Carter. Judge Carter made his ruling, and then instead of saying, bring that person in right now to testify in front of the grand jury or bring those records, he said, let me give you 7 days. So he had 7 days to coolly think about what he was going to say, and he did. And this is what he came up with.
Well, you know, what should an attorney do that has, let's just say, we'll assume a truthful allegation or complaint against the judge? What should they do?
Well,
how should this attorney have done it, assuming that these facts would have been true, these allegations?
Yes, and it all depends on exactly what we're talking about, but there's several different options for an attorney, and one is to file the complaint with the Commission on the Retirement or Removal of Judges, which Judge Carter said, look, that's what he should have done.
Of course, if you think the case that you're in front of, that would take months,
and
that wouldn't affect the case then proceeding.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
They could file something with the FBI, for example, to file a criminal complaint if they believe that type of activity rising to a conspiracy to subvert a grand jury.
But you're saying they could never file a pleading saying what they believe to be true.
Well, what they believe to be true, they have to back it up, though. They have to have some evidence of this fact.
So,
they're going to make those kind of statements.
And because, again, this is a disciplinary proceeding, which is an entirely different and lower standard than a criminal contempt proceeding. But nonetheless, even in that, you said in your brief, you say Westfall cited with approval a Minnesota Supreme Court case which says, an attorney who makes critical statements regarding judges and legal officers with reckless disregard as to their truth or falsity exhibits a lack of judgment, blah, blah, blah. So that sets a reckless disregard standard. There are a variety of other standards that could be set. I don't, is there any precedent, any guidance in Missouri law as to what the standard is of the state of mind of the attorney for criminal contempt?
Not that I have found, no. To my understanding, no Missouri courts
have used it. Any kind of state of mind submitted to the jury?
No state of mind was submitted to the jury.
Why wasn't that error?
I'm sorry?
Why wasn't that error? Going back to my first question, can you address why that wasn't even a problem here?
It is a creature of its own, again, the criminal contempt statute. It is not criminal, and yet it's not civil. And the elements were set forth as to exactly what occurred. And then the question basically was asked to the jury, did this degrade?
I understand, but we're talking about the state of mind. Why isn't that maybe one element, but isn't there a second element of the state of mind which was not included? Can you address why that was not erroneous and not submitting that?
First of all, the evidence was uncontroverted. And, I would argue to you, if that element
I'm not talking about truthfulness. I'm talking about the attorney and good faith and saying this is what my client fears, and therefore, blood my client.
Right. I would say if it's error, it'd be harmless error, because again, the evidence was uncontroverted as to what had occurred.
Was there any evidence, either in Mr. Jarrett's perjury trial, or in these contempt proceedings, where Mr. Jarrett implicated Mr. Smith in fabricating the affidavit that was found to be false?
That is what Mr. Jarrett had indicated.
Okay,
yes.
So the evidence at the criminal trial was that Mr. Jarrett said that Mr. Smith encouraged fabrications in the affidavit that was filed.
At Mr. Jarrett's trial, yes, Your Honor, that's correct. At this particular trial.
So we're asking about the mental thing here. There may have been some evidence that he knew it wasn't truthful, but you admit that there's no mens rea requirement in the instruction that was submitted.
I believe that is the case, Your Honor. An attorney cannot go up and free associate either out of emotion or out of extreme argument.
But there was no requirement in this instruction that the statement was false. The jury was not required to find that it was false or anything, just that it degraded. Truthful statements can degrade the administration of justice. The jury could very well have believed that he was being truthful and still convicted him.
I would argue with that. If he's being truthful, I don't think that would be.
Did you try this case?
I tried this case, Your Honor.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Counsel, wouldn't under this standard, if someone a motion to recuse for cause, which says someone is biased or prejudiced or tends to always decide in favor of the wife or in favor of the husband or in favor of law enforcement or against law enforcement or whatever, couldn't that degrade and make impotent the authority of the court and impede and embarrass the administration of justice?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Those would be truthful statements. Those would be statements that would be supportive.
Well, we don't know if they're truthful or not, but if you make an allegation, you're concerned about that. Well, whether or not, I mean, the motion may be denied because they find that's not truthful, but such allegations are often made.
But if you have something to back that up, Your Honor, there would not be a concern for an individual to say, look, this particular judge, here's why this judge cannot be fair and impartial, and I can say A, B, and C.
And if it turned out not to be true, then you could probably prosecute them for this, it sounds.
If it turned out not to be true, the statements that the judge was in some way.
I mean, I'm concerned that you're suggesting any criticism of a judge, if it is not later proved to be true, can be a subject of indirect criminal contempt. And why isn't that a serious problem, and why doesn't that violate the First Amendment?
As this court, as lawyers and judges well knows, there's abundant criticism of judges. But this is above and beyond because of the language that had been used, that this court has used, in that it degraded and made impotent the court. It called the judge a crook in a forum that was ongoing, and it was a proceeding that was still ongoing. And that's a matter that makes a difference as well.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you
very much.
Now, do we really have to reach the First Amendment, or can we look at the procedural issues of the court needs to state specifically how the have findings of how the Rule 36.01 was violated?
I'm sorry, I couldn't follow.
Do we need to reach the First Amendment when we're dealing with the procedural issues of specific findings on the contempt? On how your client would have impeded or done the other things required in 36.01.
It depends on at what part of the procedure we're discussing. The critical part of a procedure for indirect contempt is the required written findings of the trial judge,
right,
and the order of commitment, which must state in particularity the circumstances.
And that was not done.
And that was not done. And in my view, that would be enough to say you don't have to reach the First Amendment issue. The trial judge did not address the circumstances of, well, the First Amendment, the circumstances of the First Amendment issue. And in fact, in Wood against Georgia, that is one of the problems that was noted in that opinion, is that the record was devoid of any analysis of facts or inferences that would show how the administration of justice was impeded. And that goes also, on this record that was presented by the judge. Of course, Mr. Smith exercises Fifth Amendment right to not testify, and that can't be used against him.
What evidence, are there any cases found impeding of justice? What facts show impeding of justice? What cases have found that the action of the lawyers impeded justice?
In the United States Supreme Court?
Anywhere.
I couldn't find any on the issue of indirect contempt. I found several on direct contempt.
Mr. Galloway, let me ask a question on an issue that's been briefed but not talked about here. I understand one of your points in your brief is that Judge Witt should have recused himself because he presided over Mr. Jarrett's perjury trial. In your brief, you don't exactly say what occurred there that should have required Judge Witt to recuse himself. Is the reason why you believe that is because Mr. Jarrett actually testified at that proceeding that Mr. Smith assisted in the fabrication of this affidavit?
Actually, no.
Or something.
The two parts, and it's a fair question. My reading of Bartlett, which I think supports that proposition, says that a judge can preside over a bench trial, and I'm in negative land, if I may answer this question.
Certainly.
May preside over a bench trial and subsequently do a jury trial, unless there is something else that would make it appear unfair. And what we raised in the motion was that the trial judge for my client, had lunch with the complaining witness on the same day he was arraigned, and the county seat of the county where my client had a trial. It does raise one issue on chilling.
Did anyone ask for him to recuse himself?
I beg your pardon?
Did you ask for him to recuse himself?
Yes, Judge Wood, I did, okay, under those grounds. It does present one other issue, and one other issue. The chilling effect of incarcerating attorneys for raising issues of misconduct about the judge or the process really would apply in motions to disqualify the judges. I mean, do you want the pen of a lawyer stayed by the threat that he could go to jail for remarks that he made on behalf of the client?
Are there any further questions? Thank you.